Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Introduction. What are you doing? A voice from behind me startled me, and I turned from my seat on the picnic bench. Looks like you're writing something. A tall, bearded man, maybe 30, with a round, tan golf cap pulled down over his bushy hair, leaned forward, his hands clasped behind his back, to sneak a peek at the words I had typed on my Underwood Travel Writer typewriter. "Oh, I'm writing a book," I said. "Just starting, really." "What's it about?" he asked. "Well, I'm not really sure." I scratched my head. "Homeless people, I think. People I've met. Interesting people. People living, laughing, crying, struggling. People dying." "You can't beat a good book about people," the man said. "Ever write a book before?" "No, I haven't," I said. "I'm Michael," he said, extending a hand stained with automotive grease. "My name is Richard." I reached out my hand in return. Michael gripped it firmly and shook it as if he were pumping water from a well. "Always wanted to write a book myself," he said. "Maybe about cars. But it takes a lot of talent and time to write a good book, you know? Not everybody can do it." He was quiet for a moment. "Well, what do you know?" he finally said. "I was just going for a walk in the park, and I met a man who was going to be a famous author. How about that? Would you give me an autographed copy when you're done?" he asked. "Sure," I smiled. "Well, good luck, man," he said, and walked down a small path until he disappeared into the bushes. I turned and began writing again. I was on page 3. It was the spring of 2003. I had been homeless for 9 months now and living in the back of my van with my little white dog, Willow. I had begged enough money for a 4-day stay in the state park campground and gotten a food box from the local food bank, dried milk, pork and beans, a loaf of white bread, a jar of grape jelly, a box of graham crackers, and a big tub of peanut butter. I'd had the idea to write a book about the homeless people I'd met, and a kind man at a second-hand store gave me his small typewriter and some paper, free of charge, when I told him my dream. "Nobody wants these old things anymore anyway," he had said, pulling the red $5 sticker off the 12-by-15-inch travel writer as he handed it to me. "It needed some care. Every time I punched the R key, it would stick to the C key, and the J would always stick to the U." I wrote for 4 straight days at that picnic table, stopping only to make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch and dinner and walk my dog in the surrounding forest. Michael would walk past my campsite each day at noon. "How's it going?" he would call out, and I would respond with a "pretty good" and a wave. I went to sleep every night thinking about what I was going to write in the morning. But then on Saturday morning I woke up to the sound of rain pelting down on the van. I had taken the 30 pages I had written inside the night before, but I realized I had left the travel writer out on the table, and it was soaked. Just as well, I thought. I'm not going to write a book anyway. So on the way out of the campground, I tossed the typewriter and those first pages into a big green dumpster. I spent most of Saturday looking for work, unskilled labor of any sort, as a grocery store bag boy, anything that would earn me gas money. When that failed because I had no address or phone number to provide on a job application, I went panhandling. I slept that night in the Denny's parking lot just off the freeway, listening to the Jake brakes of the big trucks as I tried to sleep. On Sunday, I went to a free meal for the poor. It was served in the basement of a church, packed with people. I found a seat in the back. As I was lifting a spoonful of meatball soup to my mouth, I felt a tap on my right shoulder. When I turned, nobody was there. Then there was a tap on my left shoulder. I turned again and spotted someone attempting to duck out of sight. "Oh, it's you, Michael, from the campground," I smiled at him. "How's the book coming?" he asked. "A little slow today," I said. "Well, I've got something for you in my truck," he said, raising his hand and signaling for me to follow him. I stood up and followed Michael out the door to his battered blue pickup truck. Once he got the door open, he reached in and took out a cardboard box and handed it to me. "It's a typewriter," he said. "It looks a lot like the one you have, but it might be a better one. I found it in a dumpster. A couple of keys were sticking, but I fixed them and oiled it up good," he added, pointing at the box with grease-stained fingers. "Now you have two typewriters, in case one of them breaks," he beamed at me. I found some paper in the dumpster and tossed it in there, too. When I looked inside the box, I found the same old travel writer I had thrown away along with the 30 discarded pages. I closed the lid and simply said, "Thanks, Michael." "We have to take care of each other when we can," he said. Then he turned and walked away. It was then that I knew I must write this book. So write I did, whenever and wherever I could. Over the days, weeks, and months of writing at picnic tables, I attracted more and more attention from homeless people asking, "What are you writing? A book about the homeless? Am I in it?" Through the homeless grapevine, word spread about my book. It became a topic at the breakfast and lunch tables at the Salvation Army and at church dinner tables at night. I soon gained a fan club of poor and homeless people rooting for me. I felt so honored. Now I had to keep writing. I kept writing on that old portable typewriter. I wrote at picnic tables, in front of the YMCA, in city parks, in the Salvation Army soup kitchen, and in the kitchen of Bremerton First United Methodist Church, where I was allowed to live for 9 months. I finished the book while living in an apartment the people of the church had graciously helped me move into, co-signing the lease and providing financial support. On days of deep depression, including the final weeks of writing, I came within inches of throwing the manuscript in the dumpster over and over again, feeling that I was worthless and the book was worthless as well. On some of those days, I would drag myself over to sit with my editor and friend, Sandy Rice. She never failed to encourage me as she painstakingly walked this literary journey with me, helping make sense of my experience and of myself. So the book survived, and now you have it in your hands. About 98% of the events and stories are true. It's 98 proof, as some of my street associates might say. Some names have been changed to protect the innocent. The time frame of some events has been changed or adapted to make the story more accessible. But the people are as real as you can find anywhere. I hope you enjoy meeting them. Breakfast at Sally's, Chapter 1, Sally's. The first time I saw C was at Sally's. That's what the homeless affectionately call the Salvation Army soup kitchen. It's near the corner of 6th Avenue and Warren Street in Bremerton, Washington. C looked like he had just stepped off a 17th century pirate ship as he strode into Sally's and got into the serving line. He wore a navy blue wool coat and 13-button wool pants. His head was covered with an expertly folded purple bandana, and he wore a purple sash around his waist. An old duffel bag was thrown over his shoulder, and he was dripping wet from the rain that often falls on this northwest city. It was late December, the 26th, actually, the day after Christmas. At 34 degrees, it was just warm enough to keep the rain from changing into snow and just cold enough to chill you to the bone. C took a serving tray, and the lady behind the counter scooped up a big helping of white rice, a serving of carrots, and a piece of meat, and then she placed two chocolate-covered donuts on his tray. He grabbed a cup of coffee and swaggered to our table. It had the only free seat remaining at Sally's as 120 or more men, women, and children broke bread together and gave thanks for what was going to be the only meal of the day for many of them. "Fashionably late again, I see," one of the men said, greeting C. "Well, if it isn't Gentleman Jake," C responded, placing his tray down on the well-worn round table and settling in on one of the aluminum folding chairs. C leaned forward, putting his face just inches from his tray of food. "Ah, it's mystery meat again," he said. "No one seems to know what it is, not even the cook. It's shaped like a pork chop, but it says chicken on the box, and it's tasteless," C added, as he stroked his full red beard. "Just eat it," Gentleman Jake interrupted. "It fills the stomach." C pulled a switchblade from his pocket, popped it open, and began cutting up his portion of mystery meat. "It takes a sharp blade to cut this stuff," he said. C's eyes scanned the table as we ate. "I see we have a new face in the crowd," he said, looking at me. He stood up and extended his hand across the table. "I'm C," he said, "just the letter C."
"I'm Richard.
Glad to meet you," I said. "I apologize," Jake said, wiping his hand on a napkin and extending it toward me. "I should have introduced myself. I'm Jake. It's a pleasure to meet you, Richard."
"Likewise," I replied.
"Leave it to C to remind us of proper etiquette," Jake said. "Let me introduce Don, Dave, Stephen, and Lenny," Jake continued, pointing out the other men at the table. Three of the four men nodded in response. The fourth just kept eating, his head down.
"Please pass the butter, sir," Lenny asked.
"Jake knows everybody," C said.
"I should by now. I've been coming here for 6 years. I'm one of Sally's best customers."
I expected the usual battery of questions to follow.
"Where are you from?
Why are you here?
What's your sad story?"
But they didn't ask. As the men chewed on their mystery meat, a moment of silence fell over the table. Jake broke it.
"Richard, right?" he asked.
I nodded. "Well, you should have been here yesterday for lunch, right, C?"
"Damn straight," C said.
"We had a full Monte Christmas dinner by Chef Patricia. Turkey, dressing, gravy, cranberry sauce, and all the trimmings.
All you could eat, too," Jake jumped in, while downing a sip of Java.
"King 5 News from Seattle was here doing a piece on the homeless," said C.
"It was hilarious," Jake said. "You had to be here."
The major announced that the TV crew was going to be turning on the camera. He said, "Any of you who don't want to be on TV tonight or have outstanding warrants for your arrest might want to move to the other side of the room." And about 40 guys ran for cover.
"Seconds," Chef Pat yelled, interrupting our laughter. The hungriest, probably half of the folks in the room, grabbed their trays and scurried to get in line.
"Just meat and rice. We're out of carrots," she bellowed.
"You'd better get up there if you want more. They'll run out today for sure," C said.
I walked to the end of the line for my second helping of Sally's offerings. I was hungry. I had not eaten much in the past 3 days. I'd never liked the white rice, and yes, the meat was mysterious. But it did fill the stomach, as Gentleman Jake had said. And for that, I was grateful. I looked around the big dining hall as the line inched forward. I could hear Jake and C discussing the color of the carrots. C said they were an awfully bright orange, to be real.
Jake said that was because they were special carrots. "They glow," C chimed, and Jake laughed.
"It's the holidays. What do you expect? Everything glows."
The soup kitchen had no windows. The walls were painted mustard yellow, and the floor was dark brown tile, scuffed and stained. Sally's was once the phone company utility building. It was earthquake-proof. A heavy, metal-gray door guarded the entrance. Two signs were duct-taped to the door. "No firearms," and "No dogs tied to the entrance." The line moved forward slowly. "I hope they don't run out before we get there," a man behind me said. "I'm still hungry." The big gray door opened and a man stumbled in, drenched from the rain. He leaned wearily against the wall and took a soiled handkerchief from his back pocket to blow his nose.
"You're a little late, Andy," said the man behind me, greeting the newcomer.
"I've been up by 7-Eleven,"
replied Andy, slurring his words. "Let's let Andy go to the front of the line," the man suggested, and the people all waved him by.
"He's been panhandling up the street," the man whispered. "And he may have been drinking a bit," he added, laughing.
I nodded. Sally's was like a fortress to many, the only refuge, the last vestige of sanctuary. There were racks of outdated bread lining one wall and two folding tables with boxes of ripe bananas, red peppers, and cucumbers for the taking. This would be the first of many visits to Sally's Diner over the next few years. I had seen the poor before, of course. I had given to street people many times, a quarter here, a quarter there. As an affluent businessman, I had sent checks to the Salvation Army and the Union Gospel Mission.
I tried not to judge the poor as others did, but I had seen them late at night as I came home from a play or a movie, moving across the landscape like nomads, searching for the basics of survival: heat, light, water, and a dry place to sleep. I also watched them stumbling and mumbling high on their drug of choice, and I found myself judging as well. I asked myself the usual questions. Why don't they just get a job? Why do they waste their lives on booze or cocaine? Are they just lazy people who don't want to work? I was managing thousands of dollars each day at The Source, my publishing company, when it was successful. I used to send money to the poor because it made me feel good, or maybe because I felt I might be able to purchase some good karma for my buck. Besides, I could write it off at tax time. Just about every age and nationality was represented at Sally's on this day: whites, blacks, Filipinos, Hispanics, and the Indian nations were well represented. All of their faces were etched with the evidence of life's battles. Alcohol and drug abuse had taken their toll. A man was asleep with his head on the table, his food half eaten. Another man rocked back and forth in his chair, mumbling about the angels coming to take George Bush away. The man before me in line shook when he walked. A woman in the corner was crying, and the Salvation Army's major was on his knee trying to console her. Many had been soldiers, carpenters, cooks, bankers, shipyard welders, salesmen, plumbers, and artists, I supposed. Now they were the lost, the rejects, and I was one of them. How did I get here? I knew I didn't belong here. Who did? I felt I was shipwrecked, marooned on the rocks off the coast of some foreign land, driven there by a storm. Had the first mate gotten drunk and fallen asleep at the wheel? Had the captain misread his charts? Was this a ship of fools? Was there a way to hoist the sails and take us all to an island of plenty? Or was it every man for himself? Who were my shipmates? Why and how did they get here? Were they castaways like me? I always expected a carnival cruise through life, with an occasional wind-tossed day. But now I felt like a figure in a Hieronymus Bosch painting, lost in a distorted landscape, a world without credit cards, vacations, or even homes. I had lost all hope, and I saw no hope in these quarters. Of all the people in the room, I must be the saddest, I thought, because I have fallen the furthest. As the line moved forward, I could overhear three teenagers talking about their Christmas night. "Did you go to your mom and dad's?" one sandy-haired boy asked his table mate. "Heck no," he said. "You know I never go there. I went to Psycho Betty's bar and played some pool, and then I went to sleep under the Warren Avenue Bridge." He nervously pumped his right leg up and down like he was dancing to some up-tempo beat no one else could hear. "What did you do?" he asked the other boy. "I went over to Mark's. He gave me a nickel bag for Christmas. I smoked it up, and he let me crash there. We watched some TV. He got drunk. You know how he gets mean when he's drunk? I pretended to fall asleep, so he left me alone." The teenagers were young and strong of body, but they were joyless. I thought back to when I was their age. On the day after Christmas, I would be dressed in the new jeans, shirt, and tennis shoes my mom and dad had given me. I would be excited about going to the movies with my girlfriend, Bonnie, and necking in the back row of the Gloria Theater in Urbana, Ohio, near where I grew up. I would wear my Old Spice cologne and slick my hair back. The teens at Sally's had holes in their shirts. Their jeans were old and dirty, and their shoes were worn and ripped. They had no movie or milkshake money. I counted the children in the room. There were 4 boys and 7 girls. 3 of them had to be under 2 years old. Their mothers were doing what all mothers do, coaxing them to "sit up straight, Mary," "don't spill your milk, Johnny," and "eat your carrots, Billy. They're good for you." I wanted to cry. "Rice," Chef Pat barked.
bringing me back to the reason I had come to Sally's, food. I had reached the front of the line. "Yes, please," I replied, holding out my tray. Pat slapped a big spoonful of gummy rice onto my plate. "Chicken?" she asked. I had to smile. "Sure," I said. "It's delicious."
"And you're a liar," Pat said, smirking.
Jake and C were discussing the art of dumpster diving when I returned to the table.
"I found these last night in a dumpster off 8th and Veneta," Jake said, pulling some rings out of the pocket of his jeans. "I don't think they're real, but I'm going to check them out." He looked puzzled.
"I thought I had 4, he said, digging deeper in his pocket.
"Oh, yeah, here it is. I bet some broad got in a fight with her husband on Christmas Eve and threw them in the trash."
"There is a good one up near Safeway on 11th, C said. "I've found some good books in there."
I took another bite of chicken and began to tune out C's and Jake's conversation and the din of the room. My mind dragged me back to the darkness of the evening before. It was a rainy Christmas night. Homes were adorned with colorful lights while songs of the season played on the radio. Willow, my dog, was lying in the passenger seat of the old Silhouette van with one eye open. We'd been driving around for about 3 hours with no place to go. I remembered the warmth and the love that had filled my home on Christmas night just 2 years earlier, as I cuddled on the couch with my 3 grandchildren after a full day of excitement, presents, and a full meal of roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. Now I was driving south, past Gig Harbor on Highway 16 toward Tacoma, tired in body and soul. The hopes and dreams had come and gone. There was nothing left. Depression had robbed me of my defenses that had carried me through many tough times over nearly 60 years. There was no pride, no ego, just pain. I had begged God many times since last July to take me gently in the night, but he wouldn't do it. So I didn't believe in God anymore. I remembered what Ernest Hemingway wrote in A Farewell to Arms. "The world breaks everyone, and afterward many are strong at the broken places. But those that will not break, it kills. It kills the very good, and the very gentle, and the very brave impartially. If you are none of these, you can be sure that it will kill you too, but there is no special hurry." Willow sensed my despair and climbed into my lap as I drove. Tears fell from my cheeks, and she climbed up to lick them off. "It's okay, girl," I said, as I pushed her from my lap. "It's okay." I called her Willow the Wonder Dog because she was so wonderful, a 10-pound Bichon Frise, and she had been my faithful companion for 5 years and never ceased to amaze me. Willow gave me unconditional love, unlike my former significant other of 16 years, or my children, or my friends. When I was down, she sensed my despair and snuggled in my lap or tried to cheer me up by grabbing her ball to play fetch. She asked only for a little food, a trip to the park each day, and a tummy rub. We had been mostly living in our van since being evicted from our home by the sheriff in July. We slept in state parks if we had money for the camping fees. If we didn't, we tried to find any safe haven, a church parking lot, a Denny's restaurant, or the Suquamish Clearwater Casino, all of which were open 24 hours. We would find a safe spot and make a nest among the clothes in the back of the van. Then Willow would do her circling ritual a couple of times before snuggling up against me, and we would go to sleep. It was particularly difficult for me, now 59 years old, because, you see, I had not been merely comfortable. I had been a rich man. Just 2 years before, I had been living in a 5,600-foot square-foot beachfront home in Indianola, with 3 cars, 3 boats, a camper, and all the toys any man would want. I was rich not only in material goods, but also in family and friends. Some called me the man who had everything. Then The Source, my publishing business, went under, and I lost it all. The rise of the internet had been my downfall. But even then, like the true believer that I was, I expected an It's a Wonderful Life ending to my hardship.
Like Jimmy Stewart on Christmas Eve, all the people who said they loved me would rally to save me from despair. Clarence, the angel, would come to earn his wings by rescuing me. But there was no Clarence in sight this night. No snow. I didn't run into any big oak tree just outside Pottersville. I was headed for the Tacoma Narrows Bridge to end my pain, the agony, the shame, and the disgrace of this lonely, worthless life. The Mr. Potters of the world had won. I had tried to find Willow a home that morning. I took her to an old friend's house in nearby Paulsbow. I didn't have any money for a gift or for a card, so I made a card from a paper bag to give to them. We had been friends for 15 years, but that was before my financial fall and the accompanying depression and disgrace. I could hear Christmas music inside when I rang their doorbell. I waited and rang again. "Who is it?" Bob's wife called out. "Merry Christmas. It's Richard," I replied. A curtain was pulled aside and then put back in place. "Oh, no. I can't let you in. Go away," she said. "I have a Christmas card for you, and I was hoping to talk to you about Willow," I pleaded. "Bob says to go away," she yelled. So Willow and I left. We went to the park for a walk and then began driving around with the last of the gas in the car. The gas gauge was nearing empty when we reached the bridge at about midnight. I pulled into the observation area just south of the pedestrian path and took a piece of paper from my old briefcase in the back seat. With hands shaking, I wrote the note I had been dreading writing all day. "Whoever finds this van, please take care of my dog, Willow. She is the wonder dog. Please love her." I filled her cup with water and placed it in the cup holder and filled her bowl with food, hoping it would be enough until somebody found her. I cracked the windows just a little, put the note on the dash, and left the keys in the ignition. I took a deep breath, reached for the door handle, and pushed. "You guard the car, Willow," I said, stepping out. It was something I'd said to her 1,000 times before on our journeys. I closed the van door and started walking toward the bridge. I told myself not to look back. But Willow knew something was wrong. She barked and cried like she never had before. I turned to see her frantically scratching with her paws at the window, trying to get out. I hardened myself for what had to be done. "She's just a dog," I thought. That's what my ex used to say. I stepped out onto the slippery grate of the bridge and started that last walk. I shook as the cars roared past, but somehow I felt relief knowing the end was in sight. The driving gusts of wind and rain pushed against me, but as I found a place to jump, I realized that ending my life was going to be easier than I thought. A quiet numbness came over me. I could not feel the rain or the wind or hear the cars any longer. As I put my hands on the rail, I thought I heard Willow's piercing bark. "Not possible," I said to myself. "I couldn't hear her clear out here." The silence returned, and I leaned out over the handrail. Swinging my left leg up and over, I straddled it, balanced, and peered at the darkness far below. I felt warm, yet my hands and clothes were wet. I brought the other leg over. "Now," I said to myself, "jump. Now. Now. Now." Another gust of wind and rain hit my face, pressing me back against the rail, and this time I was sure I heard the barking. My best and only friend was calling. The sound of a truck roaring past startled me. I climbed back over onto the metal walkway. I felt cold and wet. I had to go back to see if Willow was all right. I had to go back. I turned and ran toward the van. The wind was pushing me forward now, and I slipped and fell, tearing my jacket and shirt all the way to the skin. Willow was still barking and clawing at the window when the van came into sight. I opened the door and grabbed her little body and clutched her close. She was panting. Her heart was pounding, and so was mine. That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright in 2009.
It is read with the permission of the publisher Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. I'm Jeff Hazen.